Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature poet and social activist Martina Spada from a special event in March 2000. The occasion of his visit to Portland was the publication of a collection of poetry called A Mayan Astronomer in Hell's Kitchen. Spada embodies, I think, what it means to be an engaged public intellectual and artist. Throughout his life, he has been a social activist who channeled his work through a variety of professions, including as a civil rights lawyer, a teacher, and a writer. He has published over a dozen books of poetry in addition to essays and translations. At the heart of his work is the collision of peoples and cultures on this continent and the force of that history on the present. He is deeply concerned with the question of social justice and what we have left out of our official histories. In 2018, the Poetry Foundation awarded him the prestigious Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize, which honors a living U.S. poet for outstanding lifetime achievement. I should note that some of this episode contains descriptions of violence and racism that may not be suitable for all listeners. Here's Espada.
I'm going to read mostly from the new collection, which is called A Mayan Astronomer in Hell's Kitchen, but I'm also going to jump around with two earlier collections, so please bear with me. I'm going to start with a poem about my name. And this is a poem that tries to capture a basic paradox of Latin American identity, that for most of us, the blood of the conqueror and the blood of the conquered run in the same veins. In this particular case, I take as a point of departure my last name, which is Espada, meaning sword in Spanish. And what does that mean if you're Puerto Rican and you know something about the history of the Caribbean? Well, of course, it refers in some way to the conquest. The conquistadores had the sword. But it also refers to the rebels. Those who resisted also had the sword, whether it's the indigenous people or the slaves brought from Africa who fought back any way they could. The fact is that for most of us, as I said before, the blood of the conquered and the blood of the conqueror flow in the same veins. And I'll do the poem now. It's a poem which refers not only to the history of the Caribbean, but the history of Puerto Rico and my family history as well. My name is Espada. Espada, the word for sword in Spain, wrought by fire and the hammer's chime. Name for the warrior reeling, helmet hooded through the pandemonium of horses in mud, or the face dreaming on a sarcophagus, hands folded across the hilt of stone. Espada, sword in el Caribe, rapier tested sharp across the bellies of indios, steel tongue lapping blood like a mastiff gorged on a runaway slave, god gleaming brighter than the god nailed to the cross, forged at the anvil with chains by the millions, tangled and red as the entrails of demons. Espada, baptizing Taino or Congolese, name they stuttered in the barking language of priests and overseers, slave's finger pressed to the blade with the pulsing revelation that a Spaniard's throat could seep blood like a fingertip, sabers for the uprising, smuggled in the hay, slave of the upraised saber, beheaded, even as the servants and field hands murmured, he is not dead, he rides a white horse at night, his sword is a torch, the master cannot sleep, there is a dagger under the pillow. Espada, cousin to the machete, peasant cutlass splitting the cane like a peasant's backbone, cousin to the kitchen knife skinning a plátano. Swords at rest, the machetero or cook studied their blisters as if planets to glimpse the hands of their father, the horseman, map the hands of their mother, the serf. Espada, sword of Puerto Rico, family name of bricklayers who swore their trowels fell as leaves from iron trees. Teachers who wrote poems in galloping calligraphy, saint carvers who whittled a slave's gaze and a conqueror's beard, shoemaker spitting tuberculosis, mad woman dangling a lantern to listen for the cough, gambler in a straw hat inhabited by mathematical angels, preacher who first heard the Savior's voice bleeding through the plaster of the jailhouse, dreadlocked sculptor stunned by visions of birds sprouting wings from his forehead, earthen wings in the fire. So the face, dreaming on a sarcophagus, the slave of the saber, riding a white horse by night, breathe my name, tell me to taste my name, Espada. I read you a poem now, one of the many lawyer poems I wrote. I worked for 6 years as supervisor of a program called SU Clínica Legal, a legal services program for low-income Spanish-speaking tenants in a place called Chelsea, Massachusetts. Chelsea is a tough little town right across the Tobin Bridge from Boston. It's a gateway city, a city of immigrants. And now those immigrants come from Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic. They come from El Salvador and Guatemala. They also come from Cambodia and Vietnam. Poorest city in the state, poorest housing in the state. So they need legal help. And so we did eviction defense and no heat cases and rats and roaches, things like that. This is a poem about a small incident in the courtroom that says, I think, everything about the inherent injustice that we saw all the time. It's called Offerings to an Ulcerated God. Mrs. Lopez refuses to pay rent, and we want her out, the landlord's lawyer said, tugging at his law school ring. The judge called for an interpreter, but all the interpreters were gone trafficking in Spanish at the criminal session on the second floor. A volunteer stood up in the gallery. Mrs. Lopez showed the interpreter a poker hand of snapshots, the rat curled in a glue trap next to the refrigerator, the water frozen in the toilet, a door without a doorknob. No rent for this. I know the law, and I want to speak, she whispered to the interpreter. Tell her she has to pay, and she has 10 days to get out. The judge commanded, rose, so the rest of the courtroom rose and left the bench. Suddenly, the courtroom clattered with the end of business. The clerk of the court gathered her files, and the bailiff went to lunch. Mrs. Lopez stood before the bench, still holding up her fan of snapshots like an offering this ulcerated god refused to taste, while the interpreter felt the burning bubble in his throat as he slowly turned to face her. Of course, that was me. Well, right around the same time, I was doing poetry readings. I was living this double life as a poet-lawyer, or lawyer-poet, some creature out of Greek mythology, you know, the body of a lawyer and the head of a poet, you know, rushing out of the forest. And so I began doing these readings in high schools and prisons and discovered they had an awful lot in common. And the next two poems come out of those experiences. This first poem is about expectations. I call them stereotypes. People who would expect me to look or talk a certain way or dress a certain way because I'm Puerto Rican. And this poem is basically a prescription for what to do in just such a situation. It's called My Native Costume. When you come to visit, said a teacher from the suburban school, don't forget to wear your native costume. But I'm a lawyer, I said. My native costume is a pinstripe suit. You know, the teacher said, a Puerto Rican costume. Like a guayabera, the shirt, I said. But it's February. The children want to see a native costume, the teacher said. So I went to the suburban school, embroidered guayabera, short sleeve shirt over a turtleneck, and said, look, kids, cultural adaptation. They didn't invite me back. I don't know why. I did a reading in a prison on the Canadian border of upstate New York, a place called River View Correctional Facility. River View sounds like an expensive apartment complex, But really, what it referred to was the fact that if you look through the bars out the window, you could see the St. Lawrence River flowing past this particular prison into Canada, following the path of the Underground Railroad that took the slaves to freedom more than a century earlier. I did the reading there and was amazed to discover that my entire audience consisted of new immigrants from Latin America. They spoke only Spanish, they had just gotten here, and there they were in prison on the Canadian border of upstate New York. And I said, with all due respect, what the hell are you doing here? And they told me they had come to New York City, they'd gotten mixed up in the underground economy because there's a lack of work, and they were caught being amateurs, and they were sent to this prison as far away from their friends and families and communities as possible. Some of them, before they had arrived in this prison, had never seen snow. And, of course, that's all you've got over there. In any case, I began to think about all the patterns or cycles of these lives, the cycles of recidivism in and out of prison, cycles of mundane prison life, the cycles of drug use and abuse, the cycles of the constant weather, the snow, and the economic and political cycles that put them there in the first place. I had to figure out a way to express this feeling of all the cycles, and so I decided to write a villanelle. It's probably the only prison villanelle in existence. And here it is. It's called The Prisoners of St. Lawrence, Rear View Correctional Facility, Ogdensburg, New York, 1993. Snow astonishing their hammered faces. The prisoners of St. Lawrence, island men, remember in Spanish the island places. The St. Lawrence River churns white into Canada, races past barbed walls. Immigrants from a dark sea find oceanic snow astonishing. Their hammered faces hardened in city jails and courthouses, indigent cases telling translators, public defenders what they remember in Spanish. The island places, banana leaf and nervous chickens, graces gone in this amnesia of snow, stinging cocaine snow, astonishing their hammered faces. There is snow in the silence of the visiting room, spaces like snow in the paper of their poems and letters that remember in Spanish the island places. So the law speaks of cocaine, grams, and traces as the prisoners of St. Lawrence, island men, snow astonishing their hammered faces, remember in Spanish the island places. I've gotten involved with prisoners' rights in another way. It was completely unexpected. I've gotten involved in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I think some of you know that name, if not most of you. Mumia Abu-Jamal is an African-American journalist on death row. He's there convicted and sentenced to death in the slaying of a Philadelphia police officer in 1981. It's a conviction and sentence that people around the world find outrageously unjust. And so there is an international movement to win him a new trial. And I've looked at this as a lawyer, and I see all the problems, the prosecution and the judge and the police. And yet there he is, very close to death. I got involved because I wrote a poem. And this poem was commissioned by National Public Radio's All Things Considered. And when they saw that I'd written it about Mumia, they panicked and they refused to put it on the air. So this led to a very public battle over the question of censorship. And a year after I wrote that first poem, I found myself sitting right next to Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row. Funny where poetry will take you. And there we were, separated only by the plexiglass between us. And I wrote a second poem, which is the one I'll read to you tonight. I got there at an opportune time. There was quite a battle going on at the prison, a wave of repression and a wave of lawsuits in response, more than 200 lawsuits filed against the prison. Mumia right in the middle of it. And when I got there, I discovered he had just come off a hunger strike. And the conversation we had about that led to the following poem. It's called Prisoner AM8335 in his Library of Lions for Mumia Abu-Jamal, SCI Green, Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, May 2nd, 1998. When the guards handcuffed inmates in the shower and shoved them skidding naked to concrete, while the blue shirts billy clubbed a prisoner to wrench the gold from his jaw to swirl KKK in his spat blood. The numbered men pressed their fingertips against the smooth, cool pages of your voice, that voice of many books, and together you whispered in the yard about lawsuits, about the newspapers. From the battlements, the warden trumpeted a proclamation. In every cell, one box per inmate, 12 by 12 by 14 for all personal possessions. You say four blue shirts crowded your death row cell to wrestle 17 cartons away, wrinkled paperbacks in pillars, toppling history or law collected and studied like the bones of a fossilized predator, a library beyond Carnegie's whitest visions of marble. One guard would fondle a book emblazoned with the word revolutionary, muttering, "This is what we're supposed to get." Today, after the hunger strike, you sit windowed in the visiting room, prisoner AM8335, dreadlocks blooming like an undiscovered plant of the rainforest, hands coupled in the steel cuffs, brown skin against the striped prison jumpsuit tapestry of the chain gang. "I would rather be beaten," you say, "than this assault on the life of the mind." You keep Toni Morrison's book in your box with the toothpaste. You stare through the glass, the towering apparition of your library, as if climbing marble steps. And you say, "Giving up a book is like giving up a child, like parting with your own flesh. How do you choose between beloved and the wretched of the earth?" Your eyes pool. A single tear is the scarification of your cheekbone, a warrior's ceremonial gash on death row. Across the glass, a reflection of the guards walking, small blue men patrolling your forehead. In the parking lot, I turn again toward the prison walls, ribboned with jagged silver loops of wire, and see a great library with statues of lions at the gate. In this same book, there's also a series of what I would call retratos, or portraits of people in the community, particularly Latino community. And I now want to read the title poem of this book, A Mayan Astronomer in Hell's Kitchen. Hell's Kitchen, of course, is a section of New York City, and this is something I saw one night. And here it is, A Mayan Astronomer in Hell's Kitchen, 9th Avenue and West 48th Street, New York, October 1998. Above the deli in Hell's Kitchen where the fire erupted, above the firefighters charging with hoses like great serpents, above the fingerprints of smoke smearing the night, above the crowd calling his name with tilted faces, above the fire truck and its ladder reaching for him, a man leaned elbows on the third floor fire escape, bronze skin, black hair in a braid, leather jacket, with a grin for the firefighters bellowing at the crowds to stand back. A Mayan astronomer in Hell's Kitchen, watching galaxies spiral in the fingerprints of smoke, smoking a cigarette. That's the newest wave of immigrants to New York City, people coming from Mexico, coming from Central America. In fact, the last time I did a reading at the Union Settlement House in East Harlem, everybody there was Mexican, whereas it used to be Puerto Rican entirely. So what do we do with all these immigrants? There's some people who want to send them back where they came from, and that would include the governor, or the former governor, of this state next door, California. But so it is, though, that the legend that is Governor Pete Wilson, or former Governor Pete Wilson, spread across the land, and soon we knew of him. Even on the East Coast. And for the longest time, I wanted to do something about Pete Wilson. I mean, here's a guy who was trying to ride the crest of anti-immigrant and frankly racist sentiment as far as he could, even to the White House. And so he got behind Proposition 187, which would deny basic human services to immigrants, and he got behind the anti-bilingual education initiatives in California. Remarkable. Fortunately, the rest of the country smelled him before he got there, and he didn't make it to the White House. But he's still around, and I wanted to write a Pete Wilson poem. So for the longest time, I'm writing a Pete Wilson poem, and it keeps coming out like Pete Wilson, you know, G-R-R-R-R. You know. But, well, that's not very poetic. So I decided to write a persona poem where I become Pete Wilson, who was very scary. I decided to become Pete Wilson asleep, his natural state. Decided to write a poem, Pete Wilson talking in his sleep, which is the only time he tells the truth. So here's the poem, like 5-minute introduction and a 10-second poem, which goes like this. Governor Wilson of California talks in his sleep. The only aliens we like are the ones on Star Trek, because they all speak English. All right, here's, I'm going to read you a poem now. I think this is the most useful of all poetic forms. It's more useful than the sonnet. It's more useful than the villanelle. It's more useful than the haiku. It is the apology poem. I recommend this to everyone. Very handy. this is a poem I wrote to my wife, and it's called, I apologize for giving you poison ivy by smacking you in the eye with the crayfish at the end of my fishing line. For Catherine. I apologize for not knowing how to fish. In Brooklyn, all the fish are dead. From the goldfish spinning in the toilet bowl to the bluefish on ice at the market with eyes like Republicans campaigning for Congress. Once my brother and I went fishing on a lake. We argued about who was rowing wrong for half an hour until we discovered that the boat was still chained to the dock. I apologize for not knowing poison ivy. In my neighborhood, everything was poisoned. The silver clouded water from the tap and the rainbow gasoline puddle at the curb. The bricklayer inside my body stacked the bricks of pollution row by row, so now, if I eat fresh vegetables, I might have a stroke. But I can sit for hours in a patch of poison ivy without a single welt, head bobbing as Joe Kuba yells, bang, bang, in the headphones. I apologize to the crayfish impaled on my hook. I am a killer with fogged vision and a tremor in my hands. I was told that if I went fishing, I would relax and my hands would stop shaking. So the crayfish, cockroach of the lake, became the panicky bait. In Puerto Rico, the cockroaches are bigger than this crayfish, and they fly. And no one uses them for bait. I apologize for tangling my fishing line in the poison ivy and whipping it free at the moment you approach me with an offering of lemonade. I apologize for the hooked crayfish, oiled with poison ivy, that flew over my shoulder like a cockroach with wings and smacked you in the eye. I apologize for the way your eye ballooned so you resembled a middleweight the referee would rescue against the ropes. I apologize for the splotches that erupted in scarlet fireworks across your face. I apologize for the emergency room. I apologize for the bills from the hospital that pile like a snowdrift against the mailbox. When the credit agency calls, I tell the man that I have a gun and I know where he works. I have decided on my penance. I will return to the lake at midnight in my swim trunks and stand there with arms spread stiff like a scarecrow beckoning mosquitoes. And as they milk my veins, I will shout this poem repeatedly till sunrise or until the police club me with their flashlights. this is one of those useful holiday poems. It's a Thanksgiving poem, and Thanksgiving is just around the corner. The setting is a place called Rocky Hill, Connecticut. It's a mythical place. No rocks, no hill. Dairy farm country. Or it used to be, just outside of Hartford. And if you know anything about Hartford, you know that now Hartford is about 35% Puerto Rican. School system is majority Puerto Rican. We shall overrun. And, of course, her parents read the newspapers and watch television like everybody else and come to the conclusion that the Puerto Rican is the boogeyman. So imagine their delight, their absolute joy, when their daughter brought the boogeyman home for Thanksgiving dinner. We've all heard of the phenomenon called poetic license, the poet's right to make stuff up. I didn't need it. Everything happened just this way, and I need to tell you that in advance, or you will not believe me. The poem is simply called Thanksgiving. This was the first Thanksgiving with my wife's family, sitting at the stained pine table in the dining room. The wood stove coughed during her mother's prayer, amen, and the gravy boat bobbing over fresh linen. Her father stared into the mashed potatoes and saw a white battleship floating in the gravy. Still staring at the mashed potatoes, he began a soliloquy about the new Navy missiles fired across miles of ocean, how they could jump into the smokestack of a battleship. "Now, Korea," he said, "I was a gunner, and the people there ate kimchi, and it really stinks." Mother complained that no one was eating the creamed onions. "Eat, Daddy." "The creamed onions look like eyeballs," I thought, and then said, "I wish I had missiles like that." Daddy laughed a 1950s horror movie mad scientist laugh and told me he didn't have a missile, but he had his own cannon. "Daddy, eat the candied yams," Mother hissed, as if you were a liquored CIA spy telling secrets about military hardware to some Puerto Rican janitor he met in a bar. "I'm a toolmaker. I made the cannon myself," he announced and left the table. "Daddy's family has been here in the Connecticut Valley since 1680, Mother said. "There were Indians here once, but they left." When I started dating her daughter, Mother called me a half-black, but now she spooned candied yams on my plate. I nibbled at the candied yams. I remembered my own Thanksgivings in the Bronx, Turkey, with arroz y habichuelas and plátanos and countless cousins swaying the boogaloo on the record player or roaring at my grandmother's Spanish punchlines in the kitchen, the glowing of her cigarette like a firefly lost in the city. For years, I thought everyone ate rice and beans with turkey at Thanksgiving. Daddy returned to the table with a cannon, steering the black steel barrel. "Does that cannon go boom?" I asked.
"I fire it in the backyard at the tombstones," he said. "Oh, that cemetery bought all our farmland during the Depression. Now we only have the house."
He stared and said nothing, then glanced up suddenly like a ghost that tickled his ear.
"Want to see me fire it?" he grinned.
"Daddy, fire the cannon after dessert," Mother said.
"If I fire the cannon, I have to take out the cannonballs first," he told me.
He tilted the cannon downward, and cannonballs dropped from the barrel, thudding on the floor and rolling across the brown braided rug. Grandmother praised the turkey's thighs, said she would bring leftovers home to feed her Congo gray parrot. I walk with Daddy to the backyard, past the bullet holes in the door and his pickup truck with the Confederate license plate. He swiveled the cannon around to face the tombstones on the other side of the backyard fence.
"This way, if I hit anybody, they're already dead," he declared.
He stuffed half a charge of gunpowder into the cannon and lit the fuse. From the dining room, Mother yelled, "Daddy, no!" And the battlefield rumbled under my feet. My head thundered. Smoke drifted over the tombstones. Daddy laughed, and I thought, when the first drunken pilgrim dragged out the cannon at the first Thanksgiving, that's when the Indians left.
As you might imagine, there's something more sinister going on there. My wife, after all, grew up in that household. And in some ways, that household, as you can see from the poem, is a kind of metaphor for the history of New England. So I want to do two poems about that history, my wife's history and then the history of New England. It's a very tangential connection, I grant you. But just before I started the reading, somebody asked me if I would do this poem, and this is the only place it fits.
The reality of my wife's life in that place, I think, comes across here. This is a very short poem called When the Leather is a Whip. At night, with my wife sitting on the bed, I turn from her to unbuckle my belt so she won't see her father unbuckling his belt. So what of the realities of the region? What about the history behind Thanksgiving? What about the Puritans? What about the Indians who left? I don't know if anybody here has ever heard of a place called Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Very few people have, even in Massachusetts. And yet, Turner's Falls was the site of a massacre of Native people on a par with Wounded Knee. We've all heard of Wounded Knee. So how come we've never heard of Turner's Falls? Well, for one thing, it happened in 1676, happened during the King Philip's War, and yet the trail is there if you care to look for it. And so I did. It's only 20 minutes from where I live. So I went and I visited this place, Turner's Falls. It's on the Connecticut River, the falls has been dammed up. The place where this happened has literally been paved over, just like the history itself has been paved over. Of course, it wasn't always called Turner's Falls. It used to be called Peskiumskut. That was the original name, and it was the place where Native American groups would gather during the spring to do their fishing and accumulate the food for the year. Well, I went there a number of times. I also did some research in the local libraries. The Puritans themselves were very proud of what they'd done there, and so they wrote it all down. Very helpful. And so this is the poem that came out of it. The Connecticut River itself becomes a character in the poem, but not the way in which you'd usually expect the river to be a character. Usually in literature, the river is all wise, all knowing, all seeing. This is a river struck dumb with trauma, traumatized into silence by what the river has witnessed. And since the river cannot speak, cannot testify, then the poet must. The other thing that's operating here is the legend of a curse on the town of Turner's Falls because of what happened there, that no good would ever come to the town. The poem is called The River Will Not Testify, Connecticut River, Turner's Falls, Massachusetts, 1999. The river's belly swirls shards of bone gnawed by water. The river is deaf after centuries of pummeling the rocks. The river thrashes all night with the lightning of lunatic visions. The river strangles on the dam, hissing at the stone eagles that watch with stone eyes from the bridge. Concrete stops the river's tongue at Turner's Falls. The river cannot testify to all the names, Peskiumskut, gathering place at the falls, Sokoki, Nipmuc, Pocomtuck. Many nations, many hands that speared the flapping salmon from the rocks, stitched the strips of white birch into wigwams. So Reverend Mr. Russell wrote to the Council of War. They dwell at the falls a considerable number, yet most of them old men, women, and children. The Lord calls us to make some trial which may be done against them. The river cannot testify of May 19, 1676. The river's face was painted blue at daybreak. Captain Turner's men, Puritans, snipping with beards and flintlock muzzles, slip between the wigwams, ghostly as the smoke from drying fish. Their muskets lifted up the flaps of bark, their furious god roared from every musket's mouth. The sleepers drenched in river's sun red, like the salmon, and a wailing rose with the mist from the skin of the river. The river cannot testify about canoes skidding over the falls, their ribs in splinters, or swimmers hammering their skulls against the rocks, or bullets hammering the rocks and skulls, or Captain Holyoke's sword lopping the branches of grandfathers into the water, or Bardwell counting the corpses vomited by the White Cascade. And Reverend Mr. Mather wrote, "The river swept them away, that ancient river, O my soul." The river cannot testify to who began the rumor. 1,000 Indians, someone yelled, 1,000 Indians approaching. So when a few dozen warriors read the smoke from gutted wigwams and splashed across the river, the conquerors fled, shrieking at the green demons that whipped their eyes and snatched their ankles as they stumbled through the forest. The river cannot testify to say what warrior's musket shot Captain Turner, the ball of lead thudding between shoulder blades, flipped from his horse and dragged off by the water to sink in a halo of blood. His name christened the falls, the town, the granite monument that says, "Destroyed 300 Indians at this place." One day a fisherman would unearth shin bones of Indians by the falls, 7 skeletons, and each one 7 feet tall, he declared. Centuries gone. The fishing boats sucked over the dam, the tendons of the bridge ripped out in the flood, the children leaning too far and abducted by the current, all as withered leaves to the river. The lumber company fire that smothered the night watchman, the cotton mill and the needles of brown lung, the knife factory brick shut during the depression, all mosquito hum and glimmer of porch light to the river. The horse thief detecting society that never caught a thief, the German military band flourishing trombones, the order of scalpers with fraternity war whoops, the American Legion dinners beery against communism, the Indians galloping undefeated onto the high school football field, all like the glitter of fish to the river. Centuries from now, at this place, when chimneys are the shadows of monsters in the river, when collapsed spires are haunted by crows, when graves are plowed to harvest the bones for aphrodisiacs and trinkets, when the monuments of war have cracked into hieroglyphics no one can read, when the rain sizzles with a nameless poison, when the current drunk in its own dark liquor storms with the crumbling of the dam, the river will not testify of Turner's falls, for the river has swept them away, O my soul.
Do two more poems. This is a poem that takes us back to Latin America, and specifically the nation of El Salvador. In 1991, January, I had a few poems published in Diario Latino, an opposition newspaper in El Salvador. Opposition to what? Well, opposition to the government, and the military, and the death squads. They're responsible there for thousands upon thousands of deaths, and it must be added, funded by the United States. And so I was very proud to have these poems published there. These people have a lot of courage. Scarcely a month later, February of 1991, Diario Latino was burned to the ground by its political enemies. While the newspaper rebuilt itself, publishing only a few pages a day, eventually Diario Latino was back to full strength. And on the first anniversary of the fire, February of 1992, the following poem appeared the pages of Diario Latino in its Spanish version. The poem, of course, is a response to the fire. It's a tribute to the courage of the people who run the newspaper. But the poem applies as well to people anywhere in the world whose voices struggle to rise above those flames. And so it's also a testament to the power of the word and the freedom of the word. Many of the details in the poem come from a letter which I received from El Salvador at that time. It's called "When Songs Become Water," for Diario Latino, El Salvador, 1991. Where dubbed commercials sell the tobacco and alcohol of a far winter metropolis. Where the lungs of night cough artillery shots into the ears of sleep. Where strikers with howls stiff on their faces and warnings pinned to their shirts are harvested from garbage heaps. Where olive uniforms keep watch over the plaza from a nest of rifle eyes and sandbags, where the government party campaigns chanting through loudspeakers that this country will be the common grave of the Reds,
There, the newsprint of mutiny is as medicine on the fingertips, and the beat of the press printing mutiny is like the pounding of tortillas in the hands. When the beat of the press is like the pounding of tortillas, and the newsprint is medicine on the fingertips, come the men with faces wiped away by the hood, who smother the mouth of witness night, shaking the gasoline can across the floor, then scattering in a dark orange eruption of windows, leaving the paper to wrinkle gray in the heat. Where the faces wiped away by the hood, unknown by the breath of gasoline on their clothes, and paper wrinkles gray as the skin of incarcerated talkers, another army helicopter plunges from the sky with blades burning like the wings of a gargoyle. The tortilla and medicine words are smuggled in shawls. The newspapers are hoarded like bundles of letters from the missing. The poems become songs, and the songs become water streaming through the arteries of the earth for others at the well who cool the sweat in their hair and begin to think. And I'll finish with this poem and then take your questions. This is a poem I usually finish my readings with. It's a poem for the new millennium. It's a poem about the future. It's a poem about hope and the political imagination. The premise of the poem is very simple. What if this were the year that justice is finally done? What if this were the year the meek shall inherit now? Okay, well, I know that no change for the good happens overnight. I also know that no change for the good happens without being imagined first. Even if at the time we imagine this great change, it seems hopeless, possible, because history teaches us otherwise, and teaches us, too, that we are the agents of that change. It comes from the bottom up, not the top down. And so that's the subject of this poem. It begins with a series of reversals. The one on the bottom is on the top, and so on. Goes on from there with this notion of the political imagination. But I can't imagine alone, so I ask you to imagine with me. The poem is called Imagine the Angels of Bread, and I'll finish with this. This is the year that squatters evict landlords, gazing like admirals from the rail of the roof deck, or levitating hands in praise of steam in the shower. This is the year the shawled refugees deport judges who stare at the floor and their swollen feet as files a stamp at their destination. This is the year the police revolvers stove hot, blister the fingers of raging cops, a nightstick splinter in their palms. This is the year that dark-skinned men lynched a century ago returned to sip coffee quietly with the apologizing descendants of their executioners. This is the year that those who swim the border's undertow and shiver in boxcars are greeted with trumpets and drums at the first railroad crossing on the other side. This is the year that the hands pulling tomatoes from the vine uproot the deed to the earth that sprouts the vine, the hands canning tomatoes and name them the will that owns the bedlam of the cannery. This is the year that the eyes stinging from the poison that purifies toilets awaken at last to the sight of a rooster-loud hillside pilgrimage of immigrant birth. This is the year that cockroaches become extinct, that no doctor finds a roach embedded in the ear of an infant. This is the year that the food stamps of adolescent mothers are auctioned like gold doubloons, and no coin is given to buy machetes for the next bouquet of severed heads in coffee plantation country. If the abolition of slave manacles began as a vision of hands without manacles, then this is the year. If the shutdown of extermination camps began as imagination of a land without barbed wire or the crematorium, then this is the year. If every rebellion begins with the idea that conquerors on horseback are not many-legged gods, that they too drown if plunged in the river, then this is the year. So may every humiliated mouth, teeth like desecrated headstones, fill with the angels of bread. Thank you. Thank you. Well, now comes the Q&A.
That's what I was told. It's in my contract. So let's have it. Don't leave me here alone. Yes. Well, the question is about the use of repetition in my work, and I think that's actually a very good question, because it is one of my favorite devices. And I think there are a variety of reasons why I rely on it. First of all, I think it lends structure to the poem. I usually, of course, do not write in form. You heard the only villanelle I've got, probably the only one I'll ever write. I do recognize at the same time, however, that poets, since we are liberated from the necessity to write in form, which at one time all poets were required to write in a certain form or it wasn't poetry, well, we've got freedom, so what do we do with it? That does not equal chaos, as far as I'm concerned. We have the responsibility, I think, to create our own forms, our own structures. So that's, for starters, that it gives me a certain structure in the poem, use of repetition. Secondly, I think it creates a very strong rhythm, right? And again, I'm not one of those poets who counts beats. You know, I'm not one of those poets who worries about trochees and spondees and where the stresses are falling on which syllable, you know. So I have to figure out another way to approach rhythm. And for me, the best way of building a strong rhythm in a poem is through repetition. But your question really goes to the heart of the matter as far as meaning is concerned, because obviously a repeated phrase calls attention to itself, and that phrase insists on its importance. It tells the reader to pay attention to the meaning contained in that phrase. And so that's also that's another strategy. There are certain things I want the reader to take away from a poem, and without telling the reader what to think, which would be a cardinal sin, I use repetition in order to draw attention to that which I think is most important. And it's not simply repetition, but I am quite fond of the specific form of repetition known as anaphora. You know, that repetition of the initial phrase, right? It comes back over and over and over again, right? I mean, you know, the classic example of anaphora is like, you know, we will fight them on the landing grounds, we will fight them on the beaches, we will fight, you know, that's from the famous jazz poet Winston Churchill. You know, I find that that's a device you hear all the time with preachers and politicians, as well as poets. It has a certain power that is deeply ingrained in the culture. You know, the power of litany, you know, the power that you hear from the pulpit. It's not a coincidence, you know, that's something that preachers use all the time. And yet it has to be used like any other device, judiciously. You know, anything else, you beat it into the ground and it becomes useless as a device. So there has to be repetition, but also variation. So sometimes when I repeat a phrase, I make sure to vary it almost every time to continually surprise or reawaken the ear or the eye of the reader. That makes sense? Yeah. How did I migrate out of the legal culture into something more sane? You mean poetry is more sane than the law? I'm not sure. What happened to me was very simple. You know, I worked in legal services. I wasn't one of the lawyers who was employed basically to make money for himself and clients. I was in legal services. And legal services money, as you may know, is soft money. You never know what's going to be there the following year, whether you're privately funded, publicly funded. It's always shaky. And one year, the funding for my program was cut back, and I was expected to fight it out with a good friend of mine for one single position that had been created as a consolidation of our two positions. And I wasn't about to do that. He was a good friend of mine. He came to this country from Chile after he talked his way out of being shot by a firing squad. That's the gift of gab. And I wasn't about to end his legal career, the most promising lawyer I ever met. And so I decided to look elsewhere, and I couldn't find another legal job in the city of Boston in legal services. I mean, just, things were really tight. So then I continued to look around and I expanded my horizons. I thought, okay, well, what about teaching? And it so happened at that particular juncture, University of Massachusetts Amherst had a position open for an assistant professor teaching creative writing. And they were looking for somebody with one book. I already had four. And so that's how I, you know, made the transition into the English department. Now, mind you, there were some people who arched eyebrows at this, and even now there are people in the English department who refer to what they call my unorthodox background, because I don't have an MFA, and I don't have a master's, and I don't have a PhD. I just have a law degree, right, which they see as a kind of vocational education. You know, no, in the halls of an English department, a JD, it might as well be a GED, right? I mean, just doesn't get a whole lot of respect. But I didn't need it because, you know, I published the books. That's all I got to do. I keep doing the work. You know, this book that just came out is my 10th book, right? And so most of the people in the English department, leave me alone. Okay. Yes, way in the back in the dark again, you. You want something in Spanish, do you? Okay, if there are no other questions, I will honor the request that has been made by the mysterious stranger sitting in the back in the dark. And this will close my presentation. What I thought I would do, this makes a lot of sense to me. Of course, at this point in the evening, I'm completely punchy, so who knows. The last poem I read you, Imagine the Angels of Bread, also exists in a Spanish version. And since you've already heard that poem, now I'll read it in Spanish and you'll know what I'm talking about. So here's the poem. Imagina los ángeles de pan. Este es el año cuando los desamparados echan a los terratenientes, mirando como almirantes desde el barandal del balcón o levantando manos en alabanza del vapor de la regadera. Este es el año cuando refugiados en rebozos deportan a los jueces que miran fijamente el piso y a sus pies hinchados al ver sus expedientes estampados con su destino. Este es el año cuando los revólveres de policía, calientes como estufas, ampollan los dedos de policías iracundos y sus macanas se hacen estillas en la palma de sus manos. Este es el año cuando hombres de piel oscura, linchados hace un siglo, vuelven para saborear calladamente un café con la descendencia arrepentida de sus verdugos. Este es el año cuando los que nadan en la resaca de la frontera y tiemblan los furgones son saludados por trompetas y tambores en el primer cruce del ferrocarril del otro lado. Este es el año cuando las manos que cosechan los frutos de la tomatera arrancan los títulos de la tierra que la hace brotar, cuando las manos que enlatan tomates son nombradas en el testamento del dueño de la enlatadora caótica. Este es el año cuando los ojos que arden por el veneno que purifica los inodoros se despierta por fin a la visión de un monte lleno de gallos estrepitosos, peregrinaje del nacimiento inmigrante. Este es el año de la extinción de las cucarachas, cuando ningún médico encuentra una enterrada en el oído de un infante. Este es el año cuando los cupones de alimento de madres adolescentes se subastan como doblones de oro y no se da ninguna moneda para comprar machetes para el próximo ramillete de cabezas decapitadas entre los capitales. Sí, la abolición de los grilletes del esclavo se inició con una visión de manos sin grilletes, entonces este es el año. Si el cierre de los campamentos del exterminio se inició con la imaginación de una tierra sin alambre de púas y sin crematorio, entonces este es el año. Si cada rebelión se inicia con la idea de que los conquistadores a caballo no son dioses de piernas múltiples, que ellos también se ahogan si son sumergidos en el río, entonces este es el año. Y que cada boca humillada, sus dientes como lápidas profanadas, se llene con los ángeles de pan. Muchas gracias. Thank you very much.
That was Martina Spada speaking at a special event in March 2000. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.